This is a podcast from Minute Media.
You are listening to the One Good Scare podcast with Natalie Zamora and Max Mallow.
Hey everyone, welcome back to a new episode of the One Good Scare podcast. I'm Natalie Zamora, joined by Max Mallow, and we have a very, very special guest with us today for a really, really exciting interview. Max and I are so, so happy about this. Today we're talking to Crystal Balint. You've seen her from shows like Prison Break, Riverdale, The Good Doctor. More recently, you've seen her in Midnight Mass as the character Dolly Scarborough, and next she'll appear in Mike Flanagan Project, The Midnight Club, based on the book of the same name by Christopher Pike. So welcome to the show, Crystal. Thank you for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Good to be here.
Yeah, of course. We are into our four-part Midnight Mass review, and we've already talked about episodes one and two, but we've said multiple times over the past couple episodes how much we love this show and how... blown away we were by everyone's performance when it came to the dialogue, the script writing, all of the different scenes. And right off the bat, because we'll get into spoilers and we'll talk about that, but you know, we just finished episodes one and two, and obviously the big reveal at the end of episode two is that Lisa gets up out of her wheelchair and she walks towards Father Paul to take the Eucharist. And yes, I want to know, as portraying her mother in the show during that scene, like, what is that like sitting there and just seeing this and knowing that everyone is going to have this, like, insane reaction to this magical moment in the show?
You know, it was a lot of fun to shoot that scene, and it was a lot of fun to sort of get into the reality, the faux reality of what that moment was like for Dolly. You know, Dolly is a sad individual when we first find her. She's dealing with a lot, and she's having a very difficult time coming to terms with all of the hits that her family and her community has taken over the last several years. So this is a really, it's obviously an incredibly pivotal moment for Lisa, and not just Lisa, but obviously the whole community, but it's pivotal for Dolly because it's the first time that Dolly gets exactly what she's been asking for. She's been praying for, what she's been holding out faith for, is for her daughter to be okay. And it's like, imagine your wildest dream coming true, and then add like another 70% on top of that. Like, it's just, you know, everyone told her it would never happen, that her daughter would never walk again, and all the, you know, all these things, all these impossibilities that she's been faced with, and suddenly it's in front of her and it's real. And so it was such a blast to shoot that and to really kind of just load that moment with all of your hopes and dreams and be able to just sort of take this wild, deep breath, because it really is this major release for Dolly and a major sense of relief. And from that point on, you get to see Dolly sort of start to stand a little straighter. And she, you know, she carries herself differently after that moment. So yeah, it was, there was so much in that moment that, and I think they did a great job of showing the range of emotions that sort of took place in that pivotal moment.
Yeah, definitely. We were just talking about, you know, just talking about it gave me chills. And I, you know, I've seen the scene a few times now just because it's mind blowing. It's incredible. And I think, like you said, Dolly in the beginning is a very sad character. And I think the Scarsboroughs in general have a very heartbreaking storyline with a lot of ups and downs. And I think, too, with Dolly, you know, she just wants the best for Lisa, even if that means kind of blindly following something sinister. So we wanted to know, like, as you personally, as a mom, was that something you were able to relate to, just wanting the best thing for your children and maybe not thinking about, you know, potential consequences?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a very different person than Dolly is, just in obviously, maybe not obviously, but it is the truth. I'm a very different person. I'm more of a skeptic than Dolly is. I don't belong to like a particular faith that I would say that's out there that I practice in the world. So I don't have that tried and true through line that I just sort of stick to in order to keep myself sort of to walk the line, so to speak. But as a parent, I could definitely empathize with the feelings that Dolly might have, which is that you just want the best for your kids. And I've been through some things with my kids. My kids had premature babies. I have twins, and so they were born early. So I've seen them already early in their little lives struggle with things. And I know what it is like to want things to just be easier. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of some place that I try to dance within and bring some of my own experience into in connecting with Dolly's story, which is that you just want it to be easier. She just wants it to be easier for Lisa. And if that means Lisa walking and not being injured, or if it means that the community is thriving, then they have the money to do what they need to do, which they don't have when we find them in the story. I can definitely empathize with that feeling of just wanting it to be better and smoother and easier. And, you know, and thankfully my kids are healthy and happy now, but I know that feeling. And there is a point where you go, I would just do anything for this to be not as complicated as it is. So I think that's where Dolly is.
For sure. And yeah, you know, the show definitely has a slow burn element to it. But this is where, for me, it ramps up and it picks up, and especially episode 3 with the big Father Paul revelation, is where it's, you know, gas to the floor, full go from here. But, you know, you mentioned that with Dolly and Lisa in that moment in the church, and how she stands up a little bit straighter and stuff like that because she doesn't know what's going on. And the show kind of explains that. We get kind of a religious answer and a more realistic answer for some things that happen in the show. You know, Dr. Gunning, Sarah, is kind of like, oh, it could have been a misdiagnosis. Who knows? She could have been healing this entire time. But for those who have finished the show, we know there's something else at play here. You know, for you, especially alongside Wade, as this is going on, and in episode 3 when stuff, you know, the proverbial S-word hits the fan, like, how did you get yourself in that mindset of just being like, okay, cool, this mysterious character has come to our home on this island, a very tight-knit community who's been through a lot, and now my daughter is walking. I will follow, like, I guess we're following this guy now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing that's interesting is that it's less, certainly those early episodes in episode 3 and 4, and then it isn't really until episode 5 that things start to shift in an interesting direction, particularly for Dolly and Wade. Because Dolly doesn't really get pulled into the fold in such a deliberate way like Wade does. Wade gets pulled in pretty early to see some of the not so great sides of the miracles, and it's only later that Dolly's kind of pulled into it. So I think for Dolly, I think it's less about following and more about just like this bolsters her faith. You know, I think she's a faithful woman. I think that's one word to describe her is that she just has faith. That's why she stays in the community. It's why she stays where she is. It's why she goes to church. She's a believer. So this is just a gift from God. It's a gift from it's the gift that she's been asking for. It's the reward for all of her hard work. It's the reward for all of her devoutness. So, and her devotion to the church and to her family. I think that's how she views it in those early times. And it's a miracle because this is what happens when you're faithful, you get what you ask for. And it isn't until later that there's like, oh, there's actually something we need from you now. Oh, okay, you need me to do more. So, I mean, and that's the interesting cycle of devotion and zealotry and sort of that follow, I go wherever you go, I will follow mentality. I think that's where it starts is you get these little gifts, these little packages along the way, these little breadcrumbs that take you to this suddenly very dark place and it's too late. Now you're in the spot.
Yeah, and I think too, like Max said, the slow burn element is part one of my favorite parts of the show, just because, you know, you're watching it and it's like, okay, that's spooky, that's sad, and then, you know, the horror elements really, really creep up on you out of nowhere, and then that's what it is. So when you were reading the script and even, you know, at the table read, what do you think was the most shocking part or parts for you?
Well, I was, so I got all the scripts all in one go. Like they weren't slowly doled out, which was nice because I could just basically binge read the show, so which was fantastic. I remember pretty clearly when I first saw the turn of events, which I can't, and that this is terrible, I should remember this, but I believe it's like in episode 3 where you start to feel things go sideways. And I remember when it started to reveal itself to me on the page that I had to go back and sort of like reread the subsequent 3, like just because I was like, did I read that? Is that what's happening? Wait a minute. And like flipping back through my script to figure out that I didn't miss something because I thought maybe I was reading it wrong. And I was sitting on my sofa in my living room and my partner was there with me, and I sort of made an audible like, oh my God, really? And he was questioning me. And of course, at that point, I realized I couldn't tell him anything about the script if I wanted him to enjoy the show, like as a viewer for the first time. So I had to keep mum on all the details for a long time. But yeah, there was that moment where when it was revealed to me that I did not see it coming. And then similar to how it unfolds as the series unfolds, you know, I couldn't stop reading it. Then I was like, I was doing reading it like while I was doing the dishes. I was like, every chance I had to read the script, I wanted to know what was coming next because it just was so wild and I did not see it coming.
Yeah, I was the same way in that episode because it starts off with Father Paul's confession. And it went through and I was kind of like, wait a second, I need to go back and listen to that again.
Totally.
And, you know, like you mentioned that script and reading everything like that and all those reveals and revelations that come to light in the show. We've been big fans of Mike Flanagan for years now. Obviously, The Haunting of Hill House was something that put him on a massive mainstream map. And then he obviously followed up with Bly Manor. But for me, like Midnight Mass has blown it out of the water compared to those two projects. And obviously, you're now tagged to be on The Midnight Club, which is also his next project. How much were you of a fan of his, or what did you know about Mike before working with him on Midnight Mass and now obviously the upcoming Midnight Club?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a little embarrassed to say I'm not a horror fan.
Totally fine. Totally fine. Like,
so here's the thing is I'm such a wuss. It's not that I'm like, I don't appreciate the genre or like that there isn't like great things in the genre. I just am like such a sissy. Like I cannot stomach it. I have a very vivid imagination. I have like almost a photographic memory. So things stick in my brain, like burned images. Like I still have nightmares about The Ring, or I have nightmares about like Bent Neck Lady. I will never unsee that. Like
amazing.
that is just burned into my brain.
Yeah.
So when I auditioned for the project, I didn't know really anything about, I mean, I'd seen Haunting of Hill House come across my Netflix feed, but I'd never, like, I just sort of went like, next, I'm not going to watch that. It's too scary. But when I got the job, of course, when I realized that it was Mike Flanagan and I thought, okay, well, we should at least go watch that. And my partner and I binged it over like 2 nights or something. We just couldn't turn away because it was so good. And we were floored by the depth of the show because I was expecting it to be like a, you know, sort of a, not light, but just a sort of somewhat shallow horror show with some scares and some jumps and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we were just pulled right into the story. The characters were so well-rounded and so well-acted and the writing was so on point. And I could stomach the scares because I just was curious about what was going on with the characters. That didn't matter to me. So, I became a fan very quickly. And then I couldn't wait to start working on the show. And I was just so impressed with how the show unfolded and working with all of, not just Mike, but obviously the people he keeps around him, you know, all of the wonderful actors and the troupe of actors that like to work with him. So now I'm just like, I'm Flanagan for life now. Like he could ask me to come on set and hold the door and I'd be like, yep, just don't even have to pay me, I'll be there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we were really big fans of his, like Max said, but I think it's only natural you're going to compare, you know, projects by the same filmmaker, and I don't really like to do that, but this show is, you know, Max and I said this is our favorite show of the year. This is by far the best thing I think Mike Flanagan has done. And it's just, it's very, very different than everything else too. And I feel like the show also is very, very unique because it tackles religion. Obviously that's a huge part of it, but instead of kind of bashing religion, it's really more about, you know, the characters' motivations and why they themselves want to choose faith. was the fact that this show is actually pretty respectful to religion, especially compared to a lot of the other horror media that we see. Something you had in mind when joining the show at all?
Well, I mean, I signed on the dotted line of the contract before I'd read the script. So I sort of was like, I was already in, I was contracted. So when I read it, I remember thinking, you know, again, as the story starts to unfold and all of those twists and turns start to reveal themselves, I remember thinking quite clearly, oh, wow, this is going to ruffle some feathers. Like, there's going to be people that are going to be pretty upset, pretty anti what we're discussing here, or the parallels that we're putting together in the show that Mike has put together. And even while shooting, I remember having those types of conversations, you know, behind the scenes while we got into some of the heavier stuff and as the show goes on. And so I was holding my breath a little bit when the show was released. And I have some friends who are practicing Catholics, who are, you know, very faithful, who very much, that's a big part of who they are. And they've seen the show. And I have yet to have somebody come to me with a complaint about how the religion was dealt with. And I think part of that reason, and this is only an assumption for me, is that Mike just dealt with it in such a thorough and delicate way. I mean, it's all very well thought out. He spent so much time on this project. I mean, it's like over 10 years of his life fleshing out this story. And he also spent a fair bit of time in the church. He was an altar boy, and he's been very outspoken about that. So he knows it so well that it's very difficult to pick apart the arguments and the dialogue, because he was like in it, you know, and it's beautifully written. And he uses it in such a way that I just think is like, it's really lovely. And I think what a lot of people are able to sort of separate is the fact that the story's not, it's less a scathing criticism of religion and more about what people do, like what religion in the wrong hands can do, and what zealotry in the wrong, you know, how that there's extremes in everything. Yeah. And it's really more an examination of people's moral codes than it is about religion. I mean, the religion stops being an issue at one point, and it's all about how people are behaving. So I think that's what people are able to, it seems like that's what people are able to actually sort of ascertain from the show.
Yeah. And, you know, this cast front to back is stellar in portraying every character totally. That Mike Flanagan has put to screen here in Midnight Mass. And we don't have a lot of time to meet every character, but mm-hmm. I feel like every moment is very important and does a great job at either explaining their story or explaining their motivations and why they are where they are. You know, I think of Lisa's scene with Joe Colley in his trailer is such a powerful scene. Like we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, the scene in the church. And everyone, I mean, when Hamish Linklater is giving his sermons, Natalie and I were like eyes glued to the screen and ears as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder if like sitting in either scenes in the church or wherever else throughout the course of the show, and you've been on other big projects, things like Prison Break, Riverdale, The Good Doctor, these massive cable network shows that have huge followings. And this is only 7 episodes, but did you guys feel as like a cast and crew that when you were making this, that it was going to be something special, that was going to be well-renowned by everybody? And it was like, yeah, we're making something here.
I mean, I think so. Like I can't speak for everyone else, but I know the conversations that we'd had, certainly after we finished shooting, that there was something really special about this project from a number of different places and different directions. Like it was a very unique time. Obviously we shot the whole thing during the pandemic. We were one of the first shows back up and running after the lockdown. So that was unique. No one had ever been through this before. So every single person on the set, from the top of the, you know, from the executive producers right down to the person who's, you know, picking you up at your trailers, you know, like every single person was like square one. No one knew what to do. So that was really unique. But I also think that the subject matter and the project itself, the things that Mike created, the characters he created, the dialogue that he'd written, all of the way in which the story unfolds, I think we all really felt that it was something very unique. And back at our table read in March before the lockdown, we got an opportunity to sit down as a cast and read all 7 episodes just in one sitting, which was really tremendous. And even at that point, you know, hearing those, the, you know, some of the things that you mentioned, Hamish's homilies and sermons, the scenes between Zach and Kate, just on the page, like just reading them, you know, Lisa's monologue and her scene with Joe Colley was like, people were crying in the room back in March. This is like, and then we still had 5 months to work on our stuff. So I remember coming home from that table read and saying to my partner, like, this is going to be really cool. Like Hamish is going to blow this part out of the water. And like Sam Sloyan is going to kill this part. And like already I was in such in love with all these characters and what the people had created. So yeah, I think I'd be lying if I didn't think that, if I didn't think that, like, I would have been surprised if people hadn't liked it that way. That would have been more surprising to me if like, cause I thought for sure that people were going to get something out of this show because it just it's too impactful a piece of writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the talent definitely is not wasted on the characters, because just like all of the cast, you guys are fantastic in this, and each character is so, so complex. And like Max was saying, we don't get to know each character that well because there's only 7 episodes, but I don't think it really matters. Like everyone is just so, so complex and interesting. So we want to know, if you didn't play Dolly, is there a character that you would have wanted to play? And is that your favorite character, or do you have a different favorite character?
Okay, so I've been asked this before, and I've thought about it a couple different ways, but I think for me, if I were going to take a swing at another character, I would say Bev, because, and not literally take a swing, of course, because I know a lot of people want to, but I don't. I think that Bev is just like the, as an actor, I think that Bev is just like the biggest, chunkiest piece of like meat that you could dig your heels into, you know, just like sink your teeth into. I think it's written, her character's written so wonderfully. It's so complex. The dialogue is so, like, there's so many beautiful pieces of dialogue that she has with that relate to, like, just, you know, Bible text and how she uses it, how manipulative it is. And that's, I just loved it. And I got to spend a fair bit of time with Sam, and I've gotten to know her personally as well. And she's just like this incredible woman who is so, could not be on the farther on the other end of the spectrum from Bev. If you have to have a separate spectrum. I mean, she's literally so different from Bev. And so it was so great to see her turn into Bev, because she'd just be this lovely person that you'd be hanging out with in the green room. And then you'd go to set and she'd be Bev and you'd go like, oh my God. And so when I watched her in the show, I couldn't look away. I just was like, it was a beautiful thing. So that I'm somewhat envious of that opportunity, because I just think it would be so rich and so much fun, but I couldn't in any way hold a candle to what Sam has done with that character. Cause she's just like, she's the character you love to hate, you know?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't get, you know, we get a lot of backstory, especially in the beginning, for Riley, and for Aaron, and why they are back on the island and stuff like that. And when we meet Bev is, been this way for how long, we don't know. Apparently we assume the entirety of her life, and I believe it's either episode three, which we will be reviewing in the upcoming week. We get the scene in the school with Sheriff Hassan and everyone, and they're talking about, trying not to spoil too much for those who haven't obviously caught up yet, but the idea of teaching the Bible in school. And mm-hmm. That scene for me was so masterfully acted by Samantha Sloyan here as Bev, as she's explaining and twisting everything to either be explained by the Bible, or there's a reason for the Bible and why I'm talking about it, and just trying to navigate her way through the conversation was absolutely like horrifying and terrifying to me as I'm watching this. And I feel like I'm in the classroom and I want to like speak up and say something and be like, is anyone going to say something here? But I was curious about that scene as well, because, and it's okay to spoil it here.
Okay.
For some like character motivations, but it's very unsure who in the room is siding with our sheriff, who is portrayed to be, you know, a newcomer to the island, someone who is an outsider more or less to the community. Mm-hmm. And I personally couldn't tell who in the room was on the side of Bev and being like understanding of her and thinking the sheriff should ease up a little bit, or if the sheriff was right and Bev should ease up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just, again, like, that's a testament to the writing, you know, and the research that went into all of the characters and the writing that, you know, that Mike gave us. I mean, like, it is the argument, right? And it's not like it's not an argument that people are probably having right now in schools all over the free thinking world. You know what I mean? Like, there are these always these things like, do we keep church and state together? Do we have church and school? Do we not? You know, and if we do, then can we have all religions in school? I mean, it is a very topical conversation about how much we involve our children into these things. And again, being in the scene and on the ground and watching that be acted, it really was lovely to, there's so much of that acting that I wasn't really acting. I just was literally just listening, because it's such a compelling argument. It really is. Both actors have totally terrific and viable points. You know, of course I have to side with Bev, you know, because it's Dolly and Wade and what else, you know, I'm scared of her. So, you know, you have to, but yeah, it's, I think it's a really, that's what's so great about the writing. It's another one of those things that you just go, that's brilliant, because there is no right or wrong. Bev is not wrong, technically. I mean, is she strong-arming everybody? For sure. Is she manipulating the situation for her own gain? Absolutely. But she's not entirely wrong about what she's talking about. And Sheriff Hassan, Rahul's character, is absolutely not wrong. He's got a very valid point. So it's a really lovely scene, because it is a point where the sides start to split. But yeah, it could have gone either way. And you see, for me, like, and for Wade, we do have moments where we're like, oh, that's a really interesting point, I hadn't considered that. And then Bev eventually just, like, you know, shuts the book and drops the mic. But it's a tough conversation. It was a really well-written scene and beautifully acted.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that too, because Natalie, I don't know if you were this way, but yeah, there's not much dialogue outside of Sheriff Hassan and Bev in that moment in terms of who's talking. I think Wade does have a couple lines and terms of trying to like steer things and try to,
I think Erin speaks up at a couple
yeah,
points as well.
Yeah,
she puts her, you know, puts her face in, but she gets shut down immediately.
Right, she's like, well, actually down. And Bev is like, yeah, no, like I got this.
Exactly.
But yeah, Natalie, I don't know if you were this way too, but
yeah,
I was more looking around the room to seeing how people were reacting, yes, to the conversation that was going on, because a lot of the facial expressions in terms of what's going on. And I remember that moment when you and Wade are like, oh, yeah, I didn't really think about it that mm-hmm. way. I guess I'm understanding. Mm-hmm. And it humanizes everybody to be like, okay, yeah, yes, like, religion does seem to play a big part on this island and what's going on in the show, but everybody still here does care about each other pretty much and is very open and free-thinking in their own thoughts and beliefs, especially in the prior episode when it's extremely emotional when Joe's dog dies of the poison and everyone's standing around and being like, this is a terrible thing to happen to you, but everyone here knows what you did to Lisa. And it's very interesting to see all of the character elements portrayed across these moments, where I'm not so much looking at who's talking and what the dialogue is going on, even though it's spectacular, but also seeing how everyone on the island is reacting, because it's such a tight-knit community.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting representation of what happens when there's division in a community, right? Or in any community, regardless of the size. It could have 127,000 people, or it could have 127 people like on Crockett. There's still going to be people who have differing opinions, who are going to bump up against each other, and who aren't going to be able to make space for the other people's opinions. There's just, that's sort of, and that is, again, just a thing to examine in the show, is it's about humanity. It's about morality. It's about, like, what we do in those positions of faith or power or, you know, what have you. And yeah, it's a conversation, like one of the very many conversations that come out of the show. It's that it's just, they're rich, that you could talk about for hours with people, really.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, we are obsessed with the show. We can't say good enough things about it, truly. It was such a pleasant surprise for people who were already fans of Mike Flanagan's work, too. So amazing. I think we have one question left for you, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much you could say, but The Midnight Club comes out next year, Netflix, everyone watch it. we know you can't say much about it, but is there anything that you can tease that will get people excited for this?
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that it's a Christopher Pike adaptation. So Mike is an incredible, you know, screenplay or screenwriter and adapter, obviously, with Hill House and Bloodline Manor. So I think you can expect that he's going to do something really interesting with Christopher Pike's work. And if anyone's a fan of Christopher Pike's work, which I was as a kid, I read a number of his books, which is why I'm excited to be a part of it and to see it. He's done some really unique stuff with the material, as you can only imagine, because that's Mike. And I'm also really excited for people to see it because there's some really tremendously talented people in it. And there's some new faces to the Flanagan family of actors. You'll see some familiar faces as well, which will be exciting, I'm sure, for the fans of his work. But I think it's really going to be a really kind of a cool ride. It's something different than what he's done in the past. It's a sort of a slightly younger audience, actors and younger audience, because it's Christopher Pike work, but there's going to be something for everyone. And I think you can expect to have that same sort of tension and that same sort of thrill and that same sort of roller coaster ride through the series. So yeah, I'm excited to see it.
Amazing. I bought the book. I've never read it, but it's back there. So,
oh, great.
I have some time to read it before we start getting release dates and trailers and everything like that.
I'll give you a hint, because if you're going to read that book, you should read more than one Christopher Pike book.
Okay.
That's my only hint, because there'll be some other things that you can sort of relate to. And there's lots of great ones. So
perfect. And then Natalie, when you're done reading one, you can let me borrow it and
pass it on.
Pass it on. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Crystal, for coming on. It was awesome speaking to you. We adore the show and amazing performances from you and from everyone in there. So yeah, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us.
Thank you so much, you guys. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So thank you so much, Crystal, for speaking with us. That was really, really fun just to get to know someone who was on the set of this incredible show. So we are going to be back with our review of episodes 3 and 4, and then we'll have another episode for the rest of them as well. So make sure you catch back with us for our next episode.